It's Thursday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, French authorities raid suspected terrorists in a seven-hour standoff north of Paris.
The larger question is, you know, will the U.S. and some of the West lower the bar in terms of an opposition group being at the table in negotiations with the Syrian government?
Western diplomats continue their push to stop hostilities in Syria. Also ahead, North Korea gives indications it may launch a missile or rocket. Country music fans have something new from Carrie Underwood. It's all on today's International Edition. French security forces raided a Paris suburb Wednesday, searching for the mastermind behind Friday's deadly terrorist attacks. At least two suspects were killed during the raid, including a woman who blew herself up, and police made several arrests. VOA's Daniel Sharaf was at the scene of the raid in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis and describes what happened to International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Well, there was a huge police and military presence in Saint-Denis. It was a seven-hour standoff that was taking place with suspected militants that were holed up inside an apartment building in Saint-Denis. They had put up tape, and there were police vehicles everywhere blocking off journalists and pedestrians who were in the area. Very large media presence, as you can imagine, just coming a few days after these horrible terrorist attacks that took place in Paris. And, of course, the suspicion was that the mastermind was inside this apartment.
How did the police know to enter this particular area?
Well, from what information has been coming out, it sounds like they were tipped off by local security. We don't know exactly if that means police or anti-terrorism officials, but this is what we're getting so far, that there was a tip-off that something obviously suspicious was going on. And it turns out, of course, that obviously something very much linked to the attacks that took place on Friday was going on in this apartment building, as one of the suspects, a woman, blew herself up with a vest of explosives in a suicide move to avoid being taken into custody.
Is this raid being seen as a successful battle in the continuing war against terrorism?
Well, if we look at the casualties among police, there were a few injuries. One police dog was killed, but there were no other people killed on the side of the authorities. There were two suspects who died and several who were arrested and taken into custody. So, of course, you know, in any situation like this, I'm sure that the police and security forces would rather have arrested all of the suspects and not have anyone have died, as two of the suspects did, so that they can get to the bottom of, you know, how this entire plot was laid out, and to try and find out exactly where the other wanted suspects in the attacks, where they're hiding out, and who else may be involved in helping them in terms of logistics, weapons, and explosives, and so forth.
What is the feeling there in Paris today?
Well, in Paris, we're still seeing, you know, 4 days after these attacks, there is still very much a sense of mourning. The city, to some degree, is still a little tense, of course, and with these new raids that were taking place very early this morning, this seven-hour standoff, certainly it has heightened people's awareness that this may not yet be over for Paris, that there could be further incidents.
VOA's Daniel Sharaf reporting from Saint-Denis, just north of Paris. We turn to our social media segment with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. She's right here in the studio now to tell us about a celebrity's comment that got many people talking about race and ethnicity in America. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what are we talking about today?
So, we're talking about actor Taye Diggs. He's best known for his roles in Broadway musicals. And the reason why people are talking about him is because of what he said about his child. He was married to a fellow Broadway actor, Idina Menzel, for about 10 years, and they have a son together. Diggs is African-American and Menzel is Jewish, so that makes their son biracial.
What specifically did he say about their son?
Well, he said he hopes people will see his son as biracial and not black. Jim, any thoughts on that?
Well, I can see that might not sit well with some people.
Yes, race in America is a very sensitive issue, perhaps more sensitive than in many other parts of the world because of its history. And this is what he said during an interview with TheGrigo.com. When you call biracial kids black, you risk disrespecting that one half of who they are, and that's my fear. I don't want my son to be in a situation where he calls himself black and everyone thinks he has a black mom and a black dad, and then they see a white mother and they wonder, oh, what's going on?
Well, that's one side of the reasoning. Tell us what the public's reaction is online. Where did you go? What did you find out?
I went to BET, the Black Entertainment Television's account on Facebook and Twitter. The Facebook post had only two words with a link to the actual article, and the words are, "Really, Tay?" So here's the first comment. But, he's black, sir. Almost 2,000 people liked that comment. Another person wrote a much more scathing and controversial comment after that, which more people liked. So, as you can tell, Jim, most people seem to be against that idea.
Well, there must be at least one or two supporters for his argument.
Well, surprisingly, none at the first glance, and the closest comment I could find was in the comment section of the actual article on BET.com. It reads like this. Sounds like Tay wants to honor his child's heritage on both sides. However, people base race on appearances. Jim, obviously this was a pretty hard segment for me to write and research on, but hopefully it gives an insight into how race and ethnicity can be quite controversial, even in such a diverse and inclusive and progressive country like America. Back to you.
Well, thanks for being here. G. Abby Lee tweets for us for VOA's International Edition account at VOA_IE. And of course, you can also follow her on her own account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, after talks in Paris with President Francois Hollande, said Syria could be weeks away from a big transition. Mr. Kerry said a ceasefire envisioned by the political process agreed to by diplomats meeting in Vienna last week would help in the fight against the Islamic State and draw down the nearly five-year conflict. Mr. Kerry said the faster Iran and Russia, the backers of Mr. Assad, give life to the process, the faster the violence can taper down. Syria analyst David Leish of Trinity University in Texas told VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Kerry's hoped-for timeline is unrealistic given the unresolved task of determining who will represent the opposition.
I think he means that there will be a convening of representatives from the Syrian government as well as opposition groups. But the question has always been, which opposition groups? Now, the country of Jordan has been tasked with trying to determine which of the opposition groups are acceptable to the West and to Russia and to all of those in the group that is meeting in Vienna. This is a tremendously difficult task. And I think the larger question is, you know, will the U.S. and some of the West lower the bar in terms of an opposition group being at the table in negotiations with the Syrian government? And by this, I mean certain groups like Ahrar al-Sham and Jaish al-Fatah, or the Army of Conquest, and the Free Syria Fighters, who, according to many, including myself, are in many ways no different than Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, who are, according to the principles laid out by the Vienna meeting on October 30th and reinforced by the meeting this past weekend, are unacceptable and should be excluded. So there's still a lot of bargaining and horse trading to be done in terms of who is acceptable from the Syrian opposition. And of course, there's the Syrian government. You know, who will they accept and their supporters in Russia and Iran in terms of a viable Syrian opposition? So I think it is, frankly, wishful thinking that something of note will happen in the next few weeks regarding a political settlement with regard to Syria.
Russia on Tuesday said that it stepped up its airstrikes against Islamist militants in Syria with long-range bombers and cruise missiles after the Kremlin said it wanted retribution for those responsible for blowing up that Russian airliner now that it's been claimed as having been a terrorist attack. France is also doing the same. Is this an interesting alliance that the Russians and French seem to be forging with the U.S. now somewhat in the background?
A little bit. I mean, now there's pressure on the Obama administration to step up to meet the level of attacks that the French and the Russians are engaging. The jihadist handbook is to draw in the great powers to begin a fight and bring in the ground troops, because this will be the beginning of, you know, an end of times fight that will lead to recruitment and Muslims from all over the world coming into the area to support their cause. This is, in my mind, a convulsive, reflexive reaction when the real problem, I think, long-term, is providing governance, providing states that function. This is what led to the creation of ISIS from the very beginning, was the failed state phenomenon in Iraq and Syria. In Syria, I think it's important first to end the war, and I think there's more sentiment to trying to find some sort of political settlement between the government and a critical mass of the opposition. The question there, of course, who is the critical mass of the opposition? That still has not been found, and that is a conundrum.
David Leash says the opposition must be acceptable to the West, its partners, Syria's allies, and Damascus. He doesn't believe that will happen anytime soon, and that will delay formation of a regional alliance to take on the Islamic State group. North Korea, meanwhile, has declared a no-sail zone off of its eastern coast, and that's raising some concerns about another missile test, according to South Korean military officials. The no-sail zone began last week, and it runs through December 7th, according to the officials who mentioned it this week. In an email to VOA on Monday, the UN's International Maritime Organization said it has not received any notification from North Korea regarding a no-sail declaration. Victor Cha advised President George W. Bush as the Director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. He's an expert on North Korea, visited the country several times, and is currently at Georgetown University and an advisor to CSIS here in Washington. Back in 2012, we asked him, what's the best response from the West to a North Korea launch?
Well, obviously, before these tests go ahead, the international community needs to do all it can to try to get them to stop. Including countries like China and Russia and others that have perhaps better access into North Korea than we in the United States might. And then after these tests, you have to go to the UN Security Council and seek another set of resolutions condemning North Korea and punishing them with sanctions for these actions. But that's sort of all in the short to medium term. In the longer term, what I think is very important in the longer term is that the United States, China, and South Korea need to start having some sort of discussion about how to deal with the future of North Korea. I know this is a very difficult discussion for the three countries to have. I know the Chinese in particular are especially reluctant to have this discussion. But, you know, this is increasingly an unstable status quo. While we have peace right now, the North Korean regime is headed in a direction where things can only become more destabilizing. And that's why I think it's important for the United States and its allies and China to think very seriously about how to respond to deal with potential instability in the country in the future.
As we know, North Korea's regime has failed in so many areas, economically, agriculturally. They have a famine. Human rights is in shambles. But they have succeeded in building a robust nuclear program punctuated by rocket tests that potentially could carry nuclear warheads. What is our best deterrent in dealing with an unpredictable state like this?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the one thing the North Koreans have been successful at doing is developing their weapons programs, and in particular, the ballistic missile program and the nuclear program. They've devoted a disproportionate amount of their resources to this, but clearly this was a national project that has been going on for well over two decades now. Various administrations have tried. U.S. administrations going back to Reagan, I chart the path of every administration going back to Ronald Reagan in terms of how they tried to deal with this problem. All of them, I think, with good intent, a willingness to create quid pro quos for the North Koreans giving up their nuclear program, including political relations, economic assistance, energy assistance, food assistance. But every one of them have failed in the end to denuclearize North Korea. And you know, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I think that people smarter than myself have been in the position of trying to make policy towards North Korea. And every single one of them have had run into the same difficulties as people before and after them. So I don't know if there's a good answer here, aside from the hope that at some point this regime, even under its new leadership, is willing to make a big change in their political direction, because it's only a change in their political direction that will lead them to have the political will to give up these programs.
Analysts in Seoul say Pyongyang could launch a mid-range missile or a new type of ballistic missile, considering the extent of the coverage. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Country music star Carrie Underwood has a new hit album out. It's called Storyteller. And here to talk about it is International Edition host Sarah Williams with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong.
Ever since winning American Idol in 2005, Carrie Underwood has been making and breaking records. Now, as a new mom with a newly released album, she's making history again. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to explain. What historical first has Carrie Underwood achieved this time?
Oh, man, she's achieved so many. But in addition to her countless awards, including 7 Grammy Awards, 17 Billboard Music Awards, 11 Academy of Country Music Awards, Carrie has an extensive history of number one hits and number one albums, not just reaching number one, but debuting in the top spot. So she just released Storyteller October 23rd. It was the highest selling debut week by a female country artist of this year. It has also made her the only artist in the 51-year history of Billboard's Top Country Albums chart to have all of her 6 albums debut in the number one spot, which is a major historical accomplishment.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, have other female country artists had their albums debut in the number one chart?
Yeah, so you've had Reba McEntire, Loretta Lynn, and Dolly Parton. They've all had, you know, multiple albums, but they were not consecutive. So all of Carrie's albums, 6 to date, have debuted in the number one spot consecutively. If you go back to even Carrie's career, back the very first single of her professional career, Inside Your Heaven, back in 2005, that debuted in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, not the country chart. And she was the first country music artist to ever do so. That album back in 2005, Some Hearts, was the fastest selling debut country album in SoundScan history. It also became the best selling solo female country debut in the Recording Industry Association of American history and the top selling debut album of any American Idol contestant in the U.S. So that is how her career started, and she has been breaking records ever since.
Well, Carrie's also a new mom now and about to go on tour as well. Busy lady.
Yeah, she's about to go on tour in support of Storyteller. It starts in 2016, and it includes dates in the States, the UK, and thus far, Canada.
How has being a new mom impacted Carrie?
Well, of course, it's greatly enriched her life. She's become more grateful. She actually just recently posted an adorable Instagram video of her asking him for a kiss, and he slobbers all over her, and they're cracking up. It's very sweet. It's gone viral. She plans on taking him with her on tour, Baby Isaiah. And on her CD Storyteller, she also writes a song about him. It is called What I Never Knew I Always Wanted, and it's already sliding up the charts, and it is definitely one of her most personal songs on the CD Storyteller.
You can catch up with Nikki Strong on VOA 1 for Country Hits USA. You can also reach her on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us any time of the day or night you like at our website. That's voanews.com. A lot of other great things there on the website as well. Check it out. We're also on Twitter. Follow us. Our handle at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Dan Crafton. And I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love to have you come back and visit with us again. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The horrific ISIL attacks in Paris are the most recent examples of the group's brutality, which has been so evident over the past 2 years in Iraq and Syria. At a press conference in Turkey after a summit of the G20 countries, President Barack Obama described ISIL as the face of evil and urged world leaders to commit the resources that the fight demands to degrade and ultimately defeat this barbaric terrorist organization. In retaliation for the attacks in Paris, French warplanes, with the help of the U.S. military in targeting sites, conducted a series of bombing raids on ISIL facilities in and around the group's headquarters in Raqqa. And, President Obama pointed out, recent events in the region have shown that as murderous as ISIL is, it is not invincible.
We're taking out ISIL leaders, commanders, their killers. We've seen that when we have an effective partner on the ground, ISIL can and is pushed back. So local forces in Iraq, backed by coalition air power, recently liberated Sinjar. Iraqi forces are fighting to take back Ramadi. In Syria, ISIL's been pushed back from much of the border region with Turkey. Both in Iraq and Syria, ISIL controls less territory than it did before.
But as the Paris attacks demonstrated, it will not be enough to defeat ISIL in Syria and Iraq alone, said President Obama. The G20 nations, therefore, committed to strengthening border controls, sharing more information, and stepping up efforts to prevent the flow of foreign fighters in and out of Syria and Iraq. In addition, the G20 nations agreed that more has to be done on a humanitarian level, both individually and collectively, to address the agony of the Syrian people. While the United States, with a contribution of $4.5 billion in aid so far, is the largest humanitarian donor, the United Nations appeal for Syria still has less than half the needed funds. Finally, President Obama noted that recently in Vienna, modest progress was made on the diplomatic front in working toward a political solution to end the war in Syria, giving hope that the Syrian people and the world can unite against ISIL. The road ahead is very, very difficult, said Mr. Obama, but the United States, in partnership with our coalition, is going to remain relentless on all fronts, military, humanitarian, and diplomatic. We have the right strategy, and we'll see it through.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.